Jelen Danke, it's lovely to be here. I did 3 years of German, and one of the only words I remember is Entschuldigung, bizarrely enough. So I'm going to talk to you over the next 50 minutes or so about some of the key emergent trends in technology and their implications for education. The strange first name, Gráinne, it's Irish, but I've lived in England most of my life. I did a PhD in chemistry before moving into e-learning, and I've got two great girls who are 15 and 19 who keep me in check. And as Claudia says, I'm a professor at the University of Leicester, a professor of learning innovation. I was at a talk in South Africa a couple of weeks ago, and the person who introduced me asked me to say three things that are not known about me on the internet, which is a little bit challenging as I've got a very high profile on the internet. So I have a fear of heights. One of the best, most amazing countries I've ever been to was Iran. And I'll eat anything, but I hate tripe. I live in a very small village in Northamptonshire called Grimscote. This is a view from my sitting room. And we've had lots of bad snow over the last few years. So when we get snowed in. And the girls love it because it means they can't go to school. And this is the latest addition to the family, helping me with my paperwork. I head up the Institute of Learning Innovation. We do a host of research projects, primarily funded through the European Union. We also have teaching. We have a master's, which is available both online and campus-based. We do supervision. We have a host of international students from around the world. We do consultancy offerings. We love having people to come and visit us. So if any of you would like a spell of time in the UK, you'd be very welcome. It's a very good location at Leicester. And we offer institutional advice on the use of technologies. So this is the outline of what I'd like to talk to you about. I'm going to start by critiquing the notion of disruptive technologies or disruptive pedagogies. I'm then going to reflect on why e-learning is so important for us. I'm then going to provide you with a timeline of what I think have been some of the key technological developments over the last 30 years. And then reflect back on what we've learned from the past before looking forward and pointing you to some very good recent reports on emergent technologies. And then you're going to have a bit of a pick and mix. So try and remember these topics, and it's whoever shouts loudest will get the choice. So we could talk about learning design. We could talk about different pedagogical approaches and how they can be supported by technologies. We can talk about open educational resources and MOOCs. Learning analytics, mobile learning, social media and open practices, or digital literacies and identities. And depending on how things go, we can probably get through two, maybe three of those. I will, of course, leave the slides, so you're very welcome to get a copy of those and look at the bits that we didn't go through. So in terms of disruptive technologies or pedagogies, there's an excellent short video by Ken Robinson. It's about 10 minutes. I won't show it now, but the link is there. He argues that today's educational establishments are outmoded, they're based on a paradigm 200-300 years old, and that they're not appropriate to equip our learners for an uncertain future, for jobs that we can't even imagine will exist in the future. In terms of disruptive pedagogies, there's excellent book by John Norton, where he outlines nine key characteristics of the internet. And one of those is that he states that disruption is a feature of the internet, not a quirk. I like this quote by Einstein, education is not the learning of facts, but the training of the mind to think. And I think that's what we need to be focusing on, rather than knowledge recall, helping our students develop critical literacy skills and problem solving. Just going to show you a short video, which I think is a great example of a disruptive technology. It'll just take a minute to load. Now it's showing on my screen, but it's not showing on your screen for some reason. Yeah, that's fine. I don't know about you, but I think that's pretty pretty amazing. And these technologies are really just round the corner and will be likely to have a major impact in the very near future. I think you need to switch back, don't you? So why do I think e-learning is important? I think it's important for two reasons. Firstly, the ways in which today's technology enable us to offer students rich, interactive multimedia and a plethora of ways in which they can communicate and collaborate. Helping them to develop the necessary digital literacy skills to be able to use these technologies effectively for academic purposes, being able to promote different pedagogical approaches, and that's one of the topics we could come back to, and fostering creativity and innovation, which I think are two key skills that we need to be developing in our learners. And finally, connecting students beyond the formal educational course. But more broadly, it's about preparing them for an uncertain future in a world that's technologically immersed, where employers are increasingly looking for critical literacies and critical thinking skills, as well as problem-solving abilities. I did a talk last year at the European Parliament in Brussels for a group of vice-chancellors and rectors across Europe. And I thought it would be useful to provide them with a timeline of what I think have been some of the key technological developments and their implications for learning. And I began with multimedia resources, the ability to create rich multimedia resources around about the end of the 1980s. Of course, the emergence of the web. And it's amazing to think that the web is only 20 years old, and yet it's had a profound impact on all aspects of our lives. We can't imagine a world where we're not connected now, where we can't Google anything we want to. I was recently in India, and there wasn't very good internet. And after 3 days, my colleague texted me and said, "Are you dead? You've not been online." Because he was so used to me being online all the time. Learning objects, the precursors to open educational resources, the notion that there's no need to create a 100-101 economics course, that we could create one and share and adapt it. Of course, learning management systems in about 1995, important for two reasons. Firstly, because they made institutions realise that technologies were no longer a peripheral innovation, but technologies were a core part of the service that we offer our learners. So they set up committees to deal with learning management systems and policies around the use of technology. And secondly, they provided us as teachers with a safe environment in which we could explore the use of online resources and communication tools. First generation of mobile devices, a little bit laughable now when we compare them with what we do have. Learning design emerged around about 99, mainly driven by people here in Europe and also in Australia, as opposed to the more North American instructional design, i.e. new approaches to design to help teachers make informed design decisions that are pedagogically effective and make appropriate use of technologies. And that's a topic we could come back to later in the talk. Gaming technologies and open educational resources fueled by people like the Hewlett Foundation and UNESCO, with fundamental principle that education is a fundamental human right and therefore educational resources should be freely available. UNESCO estimate that there are more than 10 million people who can't afford formal educational offerings, and therefore OERs and MOOCs offer them a real lifeline out of the poverty trap. Social and participatory media around about 2004. Virtual worlds, interesting that there was so much hype about virtual worlds in 2005, and virtually nobody's talking about them today. Is anybody working with virtual worlds? No. See, if I'd asked that question 8 years ago, quite a few people would have put their hands up. E-books and smart devices, really kind of fundamentally changing the way we're interacting with materials. And of course, the notion of massive open online courses started by George Siemens and colleagues in 2008. And again, OERs and MOOCs are something we could come back to in the future. I asked people on Facebook a few weeks ago for some examples of nice technology clips. And the one I showed you about the seamless glass technology is one example that came back. And I got this from a colleague, Eric Duval, in Belgium. 16 classic sci-fi films that got the future right. So Back to the Future, wearable technologies. We now have things like Google Glasses. Johnny Cars, of course, self-driving cars. Milton Keynes is going to have the first set of self-driving cars in 2015, I understand. Space Oddity as a precursor to Skype. The Minority Report, an example of that seamless boundary and touchable interfaces. And again, Space Oddity in terms of Siri on iPhones. So that's the kind of interesting to look at those. They don't look very exciting now. We've got so used to these kind of things now. But it's really interesting in terms of looking forward to look back and see what's actually come true. In terms of a bit more grounded material in terms of the future, the New Medium Consortium reports, Horizon reports every year, give an indication of the technologies which are going to have a major impact in 1, 3, or 5 years' time. And they list MOOCs and tablet computing within the 1 year time frame, games and learning analytics within the 3 year time frame. Learning analytics is a relatively new field of research. It's the notion that underneath our learning management systems, there's masses of data that we could harness to better understand what our learners are doing and help them improve their study techniques. And then 3D printing and wearable technologies within the 5 year time frame. An excellent annual report from the Open University UK is this report called Innovating Pedagogies. And they describe 10 technologies that are likely to have an impact in the near future. They list MOOCs, of course, but also badges for accreditation, blurring the boundaries between formal and informal learning opportunities. Learning analytics, they also suggest, is important, as is seamless learning, learning across different devices in different ways through cloud computing. Crowd learning, being able to harness the power of social media. And digital scholarship. There's a great book by Martin Weller from the OU called The Digital Scholar, which talks about the implications of adopting more open practices. And geo-learning, being able to tag in the environment, being able to go into a museum, see an artifact, and then see how it was in the past, etc. Learning from gaming, they also argue, is going to be very important. And maker culture, the notion of things like 3D printing, changing digital into real. And finally, citizen inquiry, the notion that we can harness the mass of the public good to use for real scientific discovery and data collection. And a report from Europe recently did a survey of four sectors, the school, tertiary sector, the vet sector, and adult education, and asked what they thought were key emergent technologies. So it's a really good, detailed, empirical study of where we're going with technologies in the near future. So I'm just going to, I won't show this actually just because of time, but this is a clip from The Matrix where he's offered a blue or a red pill. The blue is to carry on with the adventure and the red is to forget it, or vice versa. So that means we now have the choice section. So here are the seven topics we could look at again. So which would you like to do first? Sorry?
Mobile learning.
Mobile learning, okay. So mobile learning... Mobile learning can now really be promoted through things like smartphones and iPads and tablet machines. And they can be used to foster all these different aspects of learning. I recently had a group from India come and listen to us give some presentations. And as a thank you present, they gave me a tablet, which is, I can't remember the name of it, but it's very small. It's a perfectly functional tablet, but it's also a fully functional Linux platform. The cost, £23. And they're planning to roll these devices out to all school children in India, which is just absolutely amazing. In our university, we've been doing quite a lot with mobile learning. In our criminology department, all the master's students have been given iPads as part of their registration fee. We did an evaluation in my team of it, and it was really positive. Over 50% of the students used the iPad every single day for learning purposes. These are students working in very difficult parts of the world where there's often little or no access to the internet. Having the iPads meant they could have all their materials downloaded onto the device. And the evaluation's been very positive of the way in which they're using these. Our archaeology department is also using tablets for collecting data in the field. And in medicine this year, all our first year students have been given iPads. So this is a picture of one of the students on the criminology course in his coffee break, just doing a little bit of catching up, just little bits of bite-sized learning anywhere, anytime, and being able to do it in the location where they're based and their work based. And some of the benefits that have been suggested by the student is the size, small and light, that they can personalise the devices and the learning environment, the ability to be able to create sound, video and images, new technologies, augmented reality and wearable technologies. So as I said, medicine are giving all their students iPads in the first year, and we're doing an evaluation of that. Also, our School of Education gives all their masters, students of international education, iPads. There, they're using iAuthor to create rich interactive material with videos and podcasts and text and images. And these are some of the things that my colleague Therese and my team lists as the benefits of mobile devices. First, their size, portability, much easier to read. The Open University UK used to estimate that you had to add on 30% more time to read from a screen versus paper. But now with these devices and retina interfaces, I think actually it's very easy to read from these devices. How many of you have got iPads or tablets? Quite as many as I thought, because usually it's quite a lot of people have them. I don't know about you, but I find, you know, it's very easy to read on the screen. It's not difficult at all. Being able to have interactivity, things like bookmarking, etc., and being able to have a good long battery life. So anytime you see the blue house, it means we're going back to base. So what would you like next? Somebody from this side. Oh, gosh. This is where I commit professional suicide, maybe. So we'll see. Good choice. OK. So digital literacies are very, very important. Our students may well be able to use technology effectively. They may well be able to Google, but they may not be able to use it for academic purposes. And this is what we need to develop. And it's a very nuanced set of skills. There's a nice report from the IPTS, which is a research centre in Seville, which talks about digital literacies, which is well worth a read, and there's a link to the report there. We can go back to 2008 from a definition that digital literacies are a set of social practices and meaning-making of digital tools, a socio-cultural view of digital literacy. And it's about a continuum from basic ICT skills to just much more complex. If we had time, it would be really interesting to get each of you to reflect on your own personal digital environment, which tools you use and why, and which you don't use. How many of you love Facebook or like Facebook? Anybody like Facebook? Okay, why do you like it? Yeah, it's a good way of keeping in touch with people. I find if I go to a conference and I meet people, I'll lose their car, but if I connect in Facebook, you've just got that connection. And it's a great way of keeping in touch with family and friends as well. Anybody down here want to say why they hate it?
I don't use it. I don't know why. but yeah, it's no need for it for me.
Okay. Yeah. Claudia?
I find it difficult to have an overview. I feel it very weird one.
Yeah, there's a lot to take in, and that's one of the things is the skills of social media is managing your network and understanding that you can't keep up with everything. And that's okay, and having strategies for finding out the things you need. Same with Twitter. a nice diagram I came across on Facebook a little while ago is this one, which gives a good picture, I think, of the interrelationship of different digital literacy skills. And Jenkins et al. Have a nice report and list these 11 skills that he argues are needed to be part of today's participatory culture. And they're way beyond basic ICT skills, making effective judgments, being able to adapt and play, to being able to navigate the different media, harnessing the power of collective intelligence, etc. And I would add creativity as a 12th. I recently did some blog posts where I looked a little bit more at the details about identity, presence, and interaction. And I think there's this interesting interrelationship in terms of your identity, your digital voice, how you portray yourself on the internet, and therefore that's how you interact with people. On Facebook and Twitter, I have a kind of onion layer of connections. There's some people I'll connect with a lot, and I know if I post something, they'll retweet it, etc. And others I interact with less. And it's also related to your presence and how much of a digital footprint, if you like, you have. So your identity is very much about how you present yourself online, and I think each of us need to make informed judgments about how we are presented. I adopt a very open approach online. Others don't feel comfortable about that. Some people use Twitter very much as a professional network, maybe just sharing resources, etc. Others use it in a much more kind of friendly way. So it's about how you interact and how you communicate with others. And each of us have to find our own aha moment. And it is good to reflect and say, well, I don't do Facebook for these reasons, that's fine. My two daughters are complete opposites. My 15-year-old loves Facebook. She's always poking me. She's always putting up emoticons. My 19-year-old absolutely hates it. She thinks it's the work of the devil. And when she comes into the kitchen, I quickly switch to email and try and look terribly professorial. And she says, Mommy, I know you're on Facebook. Get off, you're addicted. But even she can't escape Facebook because all of her friends are on there. And she went to Africa last year and her friends were putting up pictures of her and they were having to tag her with her sister's name so that she could get the attention of where she was going. So it's really quite interesting how these things affect us. And I think there are five facets to identity: reputation, impact, influence, productivity, and openness. Michael Wesch, who's a professor in America, some of you will know his little YouTube videos, excellent one from 2008 called The Machine is Using Us. And it really epitomises, I think, what the web is about and its implications. He went to his head of department and said, this is my best paper, which has been cited 20 times and read by 100 people. This video has been seen by 5 million people. So there's a real issue, I think, about how we're viewed as scholars and the mass in terms of connectivity we can get through social media. If I tweet a blog post, it goes to 6,000 people. And that's, you know, a real kind of massive scale. So nowadays, those of us who are adopting open practices are seeing far more, our work reaching a far greater audience than before. Lewin has a nice concept of life spaces where you draw circles to indicate the different parts of your life. And this is mine. So I've got a big blob about being a mother, which is good. And then travelling. I do a lot of travel, conference presentations like this. My job as being an academic is part of my identity. And then there are various other aspects like being a sister and an aunt, cooking, which I love, learning Spanish. And the little red and yellow dots are the areas where technology infiltrates those different parts of my identity. And interestingly, the only bit that doesn't have any technology is sailing. That's when I switch off, when I turn off all technologies and completely kind of get out of the technology area. So in addition to having our own digital identity, we need to develop our own digital academic voice as well, and being able to really harness and manage your network. The web is very much a two-way process. It's not just about giving or taking, it's about both. As I said in the example, in Facebook, I asked people for good technology videos. Similarly, Eric Duval in Belgium said, I'm talking to new first-year engineers tomorrow. What should I tell them about being an engineer? What are the key characteristics of the profession? And lots of us came back and gave him suggestions. So it's very much a two-way process. And it's very much about seeing where you sit within that kind of network society. And I think these new social media have fundamentally changed the way we connect, share, learn, and work. If you'd asked me 10 years ago to put up a half-baked idea on the internet, I'd have said it was professional suicide. I do it all the time now on my blog. It's a space where I kind of tentatively work up ideas over time. I recently developed a new classification scheme for MOOCs, for example. And what's great is you can put these things up, and then people will come back and say, I really like that, I'm not sure where you're going with this, or have you looked at this? So you can have a real kind of two-way professional peer dialogue with people. And it's interesting how it's fundamentally changing the nature of research. In the UK, we're just about to have our research assessment exercise, and it's still predicated on the traditional notion of traditional peer-reviewed journals, etc. Whereas in reality, a lot of us are increasingly choosing to publish in open journals, in open spaces. So what are the implications? What are the new research metrics we need to be looking at to make sense of this? presence, Mark Charles, a colleague of mine, has done a lot of work on presence, particularly in virtual worlds. And he defines presence or subdivides it into these four categories, which I think are really interesting. Mediated presence, being there and immersion. Social presence, the projection of ourselves and the perception of ourselves by others. Co-presence, being somewhere with someone virtually. And self-presence or embodiment. And there's a good link on his website, on his blog, which goes into that concept in more detail. And in terms of interaction, I like to go back to Moore's definition about interaction being between learners and learners, learners and teachers, learners and content. And Hillman et al. Extended that to talk about learners and interfaces. So here's my story, which this is the professional suicide bit. So online interaction and communication is great. It's amazing. It's definitely transformed the way we do things. But there is a darker, more sinister side. And here's an example of my own experience recently. So I've been doing online dating. Seems like a good way to get to know people, find somebody with some similar interests. And I supposedly met this person. Looked very nice. We had lots of chats. Arranged to meet in London. At the last minute, he said he had to go to Japan. Fine. Then he said he crashed his car, lost his wallet. Very elaborate story over 3 or 4 days. And then on a Friday, I was sitting there at my computer waiting. And sure enough, the email came in. Hope you got back okay. I've got some money, but I still need £3,000. Can you help? Very interesting experience, very embarrassing, particularly because of my profession. But I decided to blog about it, and lots of people commented on the blog and said it was a very brave thing to do, and it was good to expose people like this. So there's always pros and cons with these technologies. There are always good and bad aspects, and you have to be very careful to manage how you interact in these spaces. So, I think we've probably got time for at least one more. Pedagogical approaches, okay. That's good. So I wanted to show you four examples. The first is good old drill and practice. I think drill and practice is actually very important. You can't learn a language without just memorizing your vocabulary, without just conjugating your verbs. And there are lots of nice ways now in which technology can support that. Inquiry-based learning, particularly important in the sciences and engineering. Situative learning, and finally, immersive learning. So in terms of drill and practice, this is a picture of the Open University UK's e-assessment system called OpenMark. And I think it demonstrates how e-assessment tools now are much more sophisticated, way beyond simple multiple choice questions. So you can see here, you've got a chemistry question. Students can link out to a chemical drawing package and they can get very detailed, specific, personalised advice and feedback. Another example for language learning. This is a little iPad app on the left, very silly little game. You get a word, you've got images, and you have to choose which one, and if you get it right, the frog eats the image. So what does la manzana in Spanish mean? No one knows Spanish? Apple. So if you click on the apple, it goes into it. Very simple, very silly, but actually quite engaging. And when you're, I was in Singapore recently with jet lag, it was great to just sort of play with this thing for a while. On the right, one to help with oral skills. So I can click on a phrase like it hurts here, and it'll say the phrase in Spanish to me. Right up to much more sophisticated tools. This is a complete Spanish to English dictionary, so I can find details and examples of how a word is used in different contexts. In terms of inquiry-based learning, I wanted to share two examples with you. Mike Sharples and Eileen Scanlon led on a project called Personal Inquiry, which was about promoting scientific understanding in school children through inquiry-based learning. And the picture at the bottom is Doug Clough, who has led on a site called iSpot. So the Personal Inquiry project began with a detailed review of the inquiry-based learning literature, and they came up with this theoretical framework for the stages involved in inquiry learning. Find my topic, decide my inquiry question or hypothesis, plan my methods, write the way round to reflect on my progress. And they took that model and they embedded it into a tablet device. It was an ESUS device, actually, at the time. And here are some pictures of the kids going around the town with the devices, collecting various information about the environment, including temperature, etc. And then that data fed into a bigger database, which all the students use. The tool is available online. It's called Enquire. And if this is something you're interested in, I would thoroughly recommend it to you. iSpot is a site where you can upload pictures of flora and fauna. Every year in the UK, the BBC has something called Springwatch, where it asks the public to give evidence of the first sighting of spring in London or in Glasgow. So it might be the first sighting of a daffodil, for example. They've now teamed up with iSpot and they do it on this site. And it has two functions. Firstly, it's about promoting scientific understanding and interest, which hopefully leads to people going on to sign up for science courses. But secondly, that mass of data is being used by real scientists to get a rich picture of the changing ecology in the UK. So there are lots of good examples where you get this dual purpose. Situative learning, virtual worlds are good for promoting things like role play, for example. Mark Childs has recently written a book on virtual worlds if you're interested in this topic. And there are lots of examples and case studies of the simulation of medical wards or art exhibitions or archaeological digs, etc. A recent example I came across is this tool. You say what you want to understand in a different language. It immediately puts it in text at the top, translates it into the language you want to understand, and says it back to you. And I've seen this in action. It's really fast. It really works very quickly. What the implications are for languages, I don't know, and cultural diversity, but it's a very interesting tool. My colleagues Paul and Suzanne created a virtual genetics lab in Second Life through the SWIFT project, and this was used to help students get a better understanding of safety in the laboratory, and also they could collect data through virtual instruments. What's interesting is if you have a titration, for example, in chemistry, you just see the liquid going down. Whereas in virtual worlds, you can augment that with a picture, an animation of what's actually happening chemically. So it really can enhance the real face-to-face experience. And finally, a tool from Google, Google Immersion, enables you to look at a website, and I don't know if you can see this very well, but bits of the website are being translated into Spanish. So here you've got a bit of Spanish, hacer damage to the image of online learning, el director de información. So you've got bits in Spanish. And if you hover over the phrases, it oscillates between English and Spanish. So here I'm reading an article about MOOCs, but actually indirectly through immersive learning, I'm augmenting my Spanish language learning. So I make it just coming up for five. Have we got time for one more? Yes. What were people like? Why, you're quiet lot. Okay, thank you. So this is a relatively new field. This is a rather weighty definition. Measurement, collection, analysis, and reporting of data about learners and their context for the purpose of understanding and optimizing learning and the environment in which it occurs. George Siemens is one of the people who was involved in leading on this. There's an excellent annual conference, if you're interested in this topic, called LAC, Learning Analytics and Knowledge. And I like this quote, "We leave trails everywhere we go, and that data is valuable." So fundamentally, it's about harnessing the power of the information we have under our learning management systems, so we as teachers can manage the learning process, target those who are having problems, or we can give those tools to the learners themselves and say, you've been learning 7 hours this week, but on average your classmates have spent 12 hours, or you seem to be doing all your learning on a Sunday afternoon. Research shows it's better to do it in bite-sized chunks over the week. Abelardo Pardo, a colleague in Madrid, has this kind of image of what he thinks are the key stages: collecting the data, reporting, predicting, acting, and refining. And I think there's a very close relationship between how we design for learning and how we use the power of learning analytics. So learning analytics can tell us what's happened, which then can inform and improve our design for the future. Through a project called RISE, the Open University has been looking at this and shows and articulates the relationship between planning and improving learning design, specifying the learning methods, realising the delivery, student engaging, assessment inclusion, learning pathway review. So you've got a cyclical process here, and there's a link to that project which is going on at the moment. In terms of learning analytics, if this is a topic you're interested in, there's an excellent site called the Solar Research site, and it has a very, very good report which gives you a very thorough overview of the nature of learning analytics, and I can thoroughly recommend that. The slides are actually on the laptop, so you're very welcome to have them and email them around to people. But of course, learning analytics is a subset of a broader notion of analytics. This is a tool called Rescue Time, which you can put on your laptop, and it'll give you a breakdown of how much time you're spending on different things. So it might be a bit worrying if you find you're spending 85% of your time on Facebook or what have you, but it gives you a breakdown of what you're doing when. Another tool called RunKeeper is a great one for if you jog. So you can set yourself goals for your jogging. It'll record how far you've gone and where. But it also has a social dimension. So you can be in a hotel and it'll say, other people who have a similar running pattern to you who stayed at this hotel used this route. Or three people are meeting in the lobby at 7 o'clock if you want to go for a run with them. So really quite broad, and you can see how that could be applied to a learning context. There's a lot of interest at the moment in trying to come up with appropriate metadata or metaphors, if you like, visualizations for representing the data. Dashboards, for example, or using the notion of traffic lights. So red means you're not on target, green means you're on target or beyond. And you can look at different aspects, the course experience, assessment, or more nebulous things like graduate and personal goals. So you can see, in this case, a student is green in terms of stat literacy, but she's having a problems in terms of innovation and problem solving, which has got a red light. We can also represent the data numerically and compare individual patterns of learning to the average for the class. And I think the contribution of learning analytics is both as a tool to understand the learning behaviour and provide evidence to support design of more effective learning environments and make effective use of social and participatory media. So combining the learning analytics with the social dimensions of learning. And currently, people are interested in better understanding learning analytics and better visualizations, and integrating those tools into existing courses. So all of the big LMS providers are now starting to develop learning analytics tools. But also, there's a lot of interest in applying learning analytics to things like MOOCs. So I was recently in Australia, and Open to Study, which is the platform out there for MOOCs, is based on Moodle and Drupal. And they've got very, very sophisticated learning analytics behind their MOOCs. And I think a key aspect of the future will be better understanding the relationship between learning design and learning analytics, so that design is informed by past experience. So finally, it can be used to foster assessment and feedback, to promote inquiry and sense-making, and encourage discourse. So I think probably that's all we've got time for. So just to conclude, I think learning, teaching, and research is fundamentally changing as a result of new technologies. And we can see a trajectory going back to the late 80s of what the key developments are, as well as trying to project forward about what emergent technologies are on the horizon and what the implications are likely to be for us. We're seeing roles changing. I don't think it means the death of the university, but I do think institutions need to radically rethink what their purposes are. And it's also about not just online, but it's about enhancing the physical space. There's a great report from Australia called the Spaces for Knowledge Generation Report, which looks at how we can technologically enhance our physical spaces. I think it is about harnessing new media and adopting more open practices, or making informed decisions individually about how we want to interact in these spaces. And I think we are seeing new business models emerging through disruptive technologies like MOOCs, which are challenging traditional educational offerings. If you're interested in what I've been talking about, as I said, we offer a master's. I've also got a book, Designing for Learning in an Open World, which came out this year. Don't buy it, it's way too expensive. And cut that out of the video. But if you're interested, email me, and you're very welcome to have a near final copy of the PDF. I put most of my slides on SlideShare. I've got a link to my blog, E4Innovation. There's my email address, and I'm G Knoll on Twitter. Thank you for listening.